A plea in my title is obviously a nod to the great J.L. Austin and his plea for excuses, a transparent ploy to align myself with my betters. But apart from this trace of vanity, I hope the comparison might also help orient the project of this talk, so let me begin there. Part of Austin's genius was the way he employed and juggled a number of different philosophical methods, including the common sense embodied in his Plain Man and a brand of therapeutic philosophy quite different from Wittgenstein's. But he's most famously associated with, and perhaps the leading figure of, the now much maligned school of ordinary language philosophy. Unlike some less discerning advocates of that approach, Austin was keen to emphasize that an examination of what we should say when isn't appropriate in all cases. He says, such a method is plainly preferable to investigate a field where ordinary language is rich and subtle, as it is in the pressing practical matter of excuses, but certainly not in the matter of, say, time, close quote. In cases like time, ordinary language, quote, has not been fed by the resources of the microscope and its successors, and our interests are more extensive or intellectual than ordinary. The point of his plea, then, is to recommend a particular topic, excuses, if one wishes to apply a particular method, ordinary language analysis. My plan here is to reverse the polarity of this line of thought. Rather than starting with a method and recommending an appropriate topic, instead starting with a topic and recommending an appropriate method. To speak in vague and general terms, we might say that the topic in question is the world and our place in it. Admittedly, this rough characterization isn't much help. It's not immediately clear what it leaves out. For example, I take our place in it to include the fact that humans engage in mathematics, so that asking what kind of discourse math is, what governs its practice, to what, if anything, is answerable, would all count as part of the overall project. In what follows, I focus on particular subtopics that clearly fall within the scope of the world and our place in it. Toward the end, I indicate a few cherished items that may fall outside it. But first, I'd like to take up the other term in the relation, the proposed method, that is, natural philosophy. The story begins in 17th century Europe. The historical literature on what's known as the scientific revolution is deep, subtle, and contentious, including an important debate over the extent to which there even was such a thing. However that may be, the natural philosophy I have in mind arose in the early modern period in the wake of this purported change. In reaction against the preceding scholasticism, early moderns made two dramatic changes. First, the empirical input was no longer commonplace generalities like the sun warms, but of individual observations, not what happens in nature, but what actually happened in nature, as Stephen Shapiro puts it. Second, they insisted on a much more restricted explanatory basis. Everything must be explained in terms of tiny particles with a small range of features. At the beginning, of course, those of corpuscular mechanism, size, shape, motion, number, and so on. As Bacon had counseled, this was no longer a project for the study. The new inquirer was to observe broadly, to experiment, to generalize, predict, and confirm. In this way, the story goes, the scholastic natural philosophy was replaced by the new natural philosophy, and the new natural philosophy, as the story continues, was what we now call science. So, for example, we shouldn't be surprised, don't you know, that what we regard as one of history's most brilliant scientific works, Newton's Principia, was subtitled Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. So far, so good. But then one can hardly help wondering, where in this picture is what we now call philosophy? The mystery deepens when we consider the canonical lists of natural philosophers of this new sort. Galileo, Boyle, and Newton, of course. But Descartes was as central as Boyle to the development of corpuscular mechanism. For that matter, Descartes actively dissected eyes to observe the retinal image, traced nerves for his work on the physiology of distance perception, and propounded laws of motion. Even his quintessential philosophical text, in our terms, the Meditations, was aimed at opening the way for his physics, as Descartes explained in his famous letter to Mersenne. So Descartes is typically included as well. But now what about Locke? Praising master builders like Boyle, Huygens, and the incomparable Mr. Newton, he famously describes himself as an, quote, under-laborer, clearing the ground a little and removing some of the rubbish, close quote, in the service to these greats. Presumably, what needs clearing away is scholasticism in concert with Descartes and some Cartesianism, for example, innate ideas. But despite his modesty, Locke's thinking goes considerably beyond this. His early work in medicine and physiology, his collaborations with Boyle, his study of seeds and the principles of generation all fall under the broad umbrella of natural philosophy. However he thinks of himself, the fact remains that Locke both helped formulate corpuscular mechanism and, with admirable intellectual integrity, took the lead in identifying its points of tension, its apparent inability to explain object cohesion, contact forces, and ultimately Newton's gravitational force acting at a distance. Locke engaged directly with Newton on the nature of body. Newton's striking exploration of the notion apparently came to him in conversation with Locke, and evidence suggests that the third of Newton's famous rules for the study of natural philosophy was influenced by Locke's argument for the inseparability of primary qualities. Lisa Downing, an astute analyst of the period, places Locke squarely in, quote, the historical transition from Boylean mechanism to Newtonianism. Easing into the 18th century, we find Berkeley, too, directly engaged with Newton, both in his cogent critique of the calculus and in his innovative instrumentalist account of forces. Most influential of all was his reorientation of the theory of vision from optics to psychology in The New Theory of Vision. Just a few decades later, Reed makes his Newtonian method explicit, and true to his word, his work on external world skepticism comes embedded in a close empirical study of the physiology and psychology of vision and of the senses more broadly. Now, perhaps a set of principles could be developed to disentangle what we call philosophy or philosophers in all this from what we call science or scientists. But fair judgment suggests that to do so would be untrue to the spirit of the time. Margaret Wilson, who has done as much as anyone to illuminate the thought of this period, describes the 17th century framework as one, quote, in which what we now regard as two distinct modes of intellectual activity were often seamlessly combined, close quote. This seamless combination is what I have in mind with the term natural philosophy, an empirical study beginning with careful observation of phenomena, moving on to deliberate experimentation, theory formation and testing, always assessing and reassessing its methods as it goes. A mode of inquiry that makes no principled distinction between questions we tend to think of as scientific and questions we tend to think of as philosophical. This is the method I'm out to explore. And anybody who's read might recognize here the Second Philosopher or the Plain Inquirer in other writings. So, with this sense of the natural philosophical method, we're returned to the question of the relevant topic. Reed identified the suitable topics for his natural philosophical method as the material system and the mind, not far from my own rough description, the world and our place in it. As natural philosophical method developed over the course of the early modern period, the work of Galileo, Boyle, and Newton clearly demonstrated its effectiveness for the study of the material, and Locke, Berkeley, and Reed did the same for the mind, leading the way to empirical psychology. This bird's eye perspective certainly suggests that the natural philosophical method is well suited to the topic, but I think we can trace the connection more effectively by narrowing to a familiar subtopic and engaging in a bit of compare and contrast with philosophy as we think of it today. Among the many questions that can be and are posed about the world and our place in it, one of the most characteristically philosophical, as we now use the term, concerns the relationship between the two, our knowledge of that world, that is, epistemology. As a way into this subject, I hope I may be forgiven a touch of autobiography. As an eager young math major, I was baffled by the question of mathematical knowledge and stumbled unawares into philosophy. While gaining my feet there, I naively assumed that the disciplinary specialization called epistemology the theory of knowledge, would have something to offer, but in fact, the main role it seemed to play was as a potential spoiler. For example, when Benacerraf deployed the then popular causal theory of knowledge to pose a stark challenge to many forms of mathematical realism. At the time, I turned for help to empirical psychology instead. But many years later, when I strayed into metaphilosophy and adopted external world skepticism as a diagnostic instrument, it was this quintessentially epistemological challenge that led me back to its sources in Descartes and the early moderns. What struck me then, and this is the point of this autobiographical digression, was how fresh, how immediate these writings seemed. Unencumbered by centuries of philosophical theorizing, Descartes, Locke, Berkeley, and Reid addressed the problem of knowledge head-on with breathtaking directness. Though what they were doing was undoubtedly epistemology, I couldn't imagine that any of these thinkers would much care about whether the agent in some intricately described situation would count as knowing. Their concerns were much more raw and immediate than that. So with this puzzling apparent mismatch in the back of my mind, I was delighted to run across Robert Pasno's recent History of Epistemology, After Certainty. Noting the contemporary impression that giving an account of knowledge has always been the main job of epistemology, he writes, To be sure, there was Plato in the Meno and the Theaetetus, and the casual follower of philosophy's history might be forgiven for supposing that his example carried forward more or less continuously until the present day. In fact, from Aristotle to the Middle Ages and well beyond, philosophers took an interest in carefully circumscribing one or another particular kind of cognitive grasp of reality, perception, imagination, assent, deduction, and so on, but showed little interest in defining the broad category of knowledge. That English contains this very general word of positive cognitive appraisal did not strike philosophers, even those working in English, as calling for any special definitional inquiry, close quote. So here Pasno puts his finger on what had so impressed me in the early moderns. They weren't out to analyze a general concept of knowledge or to study a general state of knowing. Their attention was on isolating and evaluating particular forms of cognitive grasp. Their leading question wasn't what counts as or what is knowledge, but how do creatures like us manage to get reliable information about the world? This is just the question I once asked about mathematics. How do we gain reliable information about mathematics? The sort of question the contemporary epistemological literature hadn't helped me address. So, when our early modern natural philosophers set out to address their version of the central question, they explore cognitive roots from basic perception, distance information by sight, the significance of color vision, the relations of vision and touch, to more theoretical matters, the nature of explanation, the significance of force laws, general rules for natural philosophizing. Given the nature of their question, this piecemeal approach makes perfect sense. The way we gain reliable information about medium-sized objects by vision isn't likely to have much in common with the way we gain reliable information about molecular structure. To insist on a general answer would be to set aside the case-specific details that actually do the epistemic work. It's easy to see why the question of knowledge in general just didn't arise. From our contemporary point of view, we might try to separate the philosophical from the scientific strands in these inquiries, but these thinkers did not. Given that we now regard this as conflating questions of two disparate types, we should expect just what we find. Contemporary epistemologists, as philosophers, are asking different questions. The puzzle then becomes, how did we get from there to here? Okay, so let me float a pair of just-so stories. A likely thought is that this shift in focus of the theory of knowledge had something to do with the forces that gradually separated the two now disparate practices over the intervening centuries. Perhaps there is an established historical account of this transition, but if so, I blush to admit that it's unknown to me. There is, however, a story that philosophers sometimes tell themselves. Here it is, coming from Russell, he writes. As soon as definite knowledge concerning any subject becomes possible, this subject ceases to be called philosophy, and becomes a separate science. The whole study of the heavens, which now belongs to astronomy, was once included in philosophy. Newton's great work was called the Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. Similarly, the study of the human mind, which was part of philosophy, has now been separated from philosophy and has become the science of psychology. Thus, to a great extent, the uncertainty of philosophy is more apparent than real. Those questions which are already capable of definite answers are placed in the sciences, while those only to which at present no definite answer can be given remain to form the residue that is called philosophy. Close quote. Austin puts the sentiment in more colorful terms. He says, in the history of human inquiry, philosophy has the place of the initial central sun, seminal and tumultuous. From time to time, it throws off some portion of itself to take station as a science, a planet cool and well-regulated, progressing steadily toward a distant final state. This happened long ago at the birth of mathematics and again at the birth of physics. Only in the last century, Austin's writing in 1956, have we witnessed the same process once again, slow and at the time almost imperceptible, in the birth of the science of mathematical logic through the joint labors of philosophers and mathematicians. Is it not possible that the next century may see the birth, through the joint efforts of philosophers, grammarians, and numerous other students of language, of a true and comprehensive science of language? Then we shall have rid ourselves of one more part of philosophy. There will still be plenty left. In the only way we can ever get rid of philosophy, by kicking it upstairs. Close quote. So here Austin is imagining the birth of linguistics, and indeed Chomsky's groundbreaking syntactic structures appeared the year after this passage. For Russell and Austin, in the beginning, there is philosophy and the various sciences spin off from that source. Of course, in our terminology, what science spins off from isn't philosophy in the contemporary sense, but natural philosophy in the sense we're pursuing here. I assume Russell and Austin would take this as a friendly amendment. Okay, so appealing as it may be, I'm not sure this picture matches our case. Between them, Austin and Russell offer a range of examples, two that we've touched on already, celestial mechanics and empirical psychology, and two more recent, mathematical logic and linguistics. In each of these cases, I think it's fair to say that some residue remained in philosophy. Methodological questions about Newton's inferences, puzzles about sensations in the brain, unclarity about the nature of logical truth, and linguistic meaning. As Austin says, there will still be plenty left. Indeed, the subsequent progress of the spun-off sciences tends to create new residues, like the puzzles of quantum mechanics. The trouble with applying this picture to our present case is that the questions of contemporary epistemology, questions about the scope and nature of knowledge, don't look like this kind of residue. Contemporary questions about knowledge weren't ones our early modern natural philosophers even felt the need to ask. For cases like ours, I like to tell a different sort of just-so story. It begins with Hume's skepticism in the early 18th century. It's well known that Hume occasioned Kant's awakening from his dogmatic slumbers. What's perhaps less well known is that Hume had much the same effect on Reid. Though Kant and Reid were primarily motivated by different aspects of Hume's skepticism, inductive and external world respectively, it's easy to imagine both of them flummoxed by section 142 of the treatise, where Hume undertakes to locate the source of the idea of an external object. That source, he argues, can't be either the senses or reason. In the end, he concludes that it's a, quote, mistake of the imagination, and even this much only by a tortured argument of highly questionable cogency. Kant and Reid could be forgiven for concluding instead that the concept of object, clearly present in the cognition for Kant, or the perception for Reid, must arise from some source that Hume overlooked. Their contrasting answers to this puzzle define their respective philosophies. Reid recognizes that, quote, if nature had given us nothing more than impressions made on the body and sensations in our mind corresponding to them, we should in that case have been merely sentient, not percipient beings. We should never have been able to form the conception of an external object far less a belief in its existence. Close quote. Well, lucky for us, nature has formed our constitution so that, quote, our perceptions correspond to impressions on the organs, nerves, and brain, and vary in kind and in degree as they vary, close quote. By these means, quote, the mind passes immediately from the sensation to the conception and belief, close quote, in external objects. On careful review, he laments the then current accounts of the physiological processes from organ to nerve to brain, from Descartes to Hartley, are largely mere conjectures, but he certainly believes that this kind of study is what's needed. It just has to be carried out in line with strictly Newtonian methods. In the end, he's confident that our perceptual systems arose as, quote, necessary in order for supplying the wants of nature and avoiding the dangers to which we are constantly exposed, and that they are admirably fitted to this purpose, close quote. Of course, the good Pastor Reed attributes this happy circumstance to the, quote, parental care and goodness, close quote, of his maker. But it would be entirely consistent with this natural philosophical approach to regard Darwin as a friendly and welcome amendment. In the same spirit, his response to Hume's external world skepticism rests on an empirical case against the argument from illusion and the theory of ideas, and a challenge to the underlying assumption that perception is less reliable than our other faculties, introspection, reason, memory. Okay, but in stark contrast, Kant takes a very different route. He invents an entirely new kind of inquiry, transcendental critique. This transcendental inquiry is defined in explicit contrast to the natural philosopher's empirical inquiry. For example, transcendental psychology, quote, explanation of the way in which concepts relate to their objects a priori, close quote, is sharply distinguished from empirical psychology, explanation of, quote, how a concept is acquired from experience and reflection on it, close quote. Just as we might expect, he locates the beginning of this empirical psychology in Locke, quote, such a tracing of the first endeavors of our powers of cognition to ascend from individual perceptions to general concepts is without doubt of great utility, and the famous Locke is to be thanked for having first opened the way for this, close quote. So, exemplary as this natural philosophical inquiry is, Kant sets it aside in favor of his new transcendental inquiry, presumably to be conducted with new a priori methods. The concept of an external object is then located transcendentally in the pure categories, in the structure of the discursive intellect, and not, as Reed would have it, in ordinary human psychology. The same transcendental move informs his response to Hume's inductive skepticism. So, by the end of the 18th century, there were two very different reactions to Hume on offer, one empirical, one transcendental. Kant, being the philosophical genius that he was, bestriding the subject to this day, it's no surprise that his approach dominated. Various forms of neo and post-Kantian idealism ensued, eventually provoking the anti-idealist reaction of Moore and Russell, the rise of conceptual analysis and analytic philosophy more broadly. At that point, the quest for an analysis of knowledge naturally became a central undertaking of epistemology, which now often gives way to direct theorizing about knowledge itself. I'm thinking of Williamson here. On this picture, then, what we call philosophy separated itself from natural philosophy when Kant posited an explicitly separate inquiry with a priori methods. So this story reverses the Russell-Austin line. They have the sciences spinning off from natural philosophy. My story has philosophy breaking free from the same source. Though both are irresponsible just-so stories, mine seems a better fit for the question at hand. How did epistemology get from there to here? But once again, I think we can learn more by narrowing our focus still further, this time by looking more closely at the fine grain of early modern epistemological project, and in particular at the role of the crucial distinction between primary and secondary qualities. This time, instead of asking how the current epistemological project took over from the early modern one, my thought is to ask what became of the leading questions of the early modern project as epistemology came to focus on the nature of knowledge. Okay. So a distinction between qualities like size, shape, motion, and number on the one hand, and those like color, taste, odor, and sound on the other, first appeared in familiar form in Galileo. But to the dismay of those keen to separate the philosophers from the scientists, Galileo offered something like a conceptual analysis of what it is to be a substantial body. In the decades to come, as a distinction of this general sort became embedded in the rising corpuscular mechanism of Descartes and Boyle, Descartes' defense followed a conceptual route reminiscent of Galileo. He says, "The nature of matter, or a body considered in general, consists not in its being something which is colored or affects the senses in any way, but simply in its being something which is extended in length, breadth, and depth," close quote. So here in Descartes and in Galileo and Descartes, we see precursors to Locke and Newton in the tradition of analyzing what it is to be a body. Though perhaps not entirely immune to a priori considerations himself, Boyle most often strikes a different note, taking empirical evidence as the deciding factor. Corpuscular mechanism as a whole is, quote, to be either confirmed or disproved by the historical truths, where historical truths are observations. Appropriately circumspect, Boyle takes this observational case to be a work in progress, so far inconclusive, but he also appeals to the new theoretical virtues of corpuscular mechanism, its clarity, parsimony, and explanatory power. These precursors in the background, the canonical treatment of the distinction, its sources and its defense, indeed the very terminology of primary and secondary, comes in Locke's essay, especially the famous section 2.8. Locke dabbles with both a Galileo-Descartes-style conceptual derivation, as we'll see in a moment, and a Boylean appeal to empirical predictions and explanatory power. But setting aside how the distinction is supposed to be defended, I'd like to focus here on the question of its content. What is it that differentiates a primary quality from a secondary quality? This turns out to be a surprisingly difficult question to answer. Ed Curley refers to, quote, "those unfortunate inconsistencies for which Locke's work is so famous," close quote. Fortunately, the problem of either knitting Locke's apparently conflicting claims together or convicting of inconsistency isn't one we need to address here. For our purposes, it will be enough to isolate a few of Locke's most salient threads. So the obvious place to start is with the distinction already on the table. Having primary qualities is part of what it is to be a body. Having secondary qualities is not. In Locke's version, primary qualities are, quote, "such as the mind finds inseparable from every particle of matter," close quote. Whatever Galileo or Descartes might have had in mind with this sort of conceptual criterion, we're now concerned with Locke, for whom all cognition begins with the senses, including the idea of body. In our experience, we're to isolate those properties, quote, "such as sense constantly finds in every particle of matter," close quote, then exclude any property that the mind can separate. The result is what Locke calls the nominal essence of body, an essence constructed by us. But Locke also recognizes real essences, quote, "the very being of anything whereby it is what it is, the constitution of things whereon their qualities depend," close quote. According to corpuscular mechanism, the real essence is the corpuscular microstructure, the features and arrangements of its tiny parts. These are responsible for all the properties of body. Locke draws a crucial link between the nominal essence drawn from ordinary experience and corpuscularism. He says, "Take a grain of wheat, divide it into two parts. Each part still has solidity, extension, figure, and mobility. Divided again, it retains still the same qualities. And so divided on, till the parts become insensible, they must retain still, each of them, all these qualities. These I call the primary qualities of body, which I think we may observe to produce simple ideas in us, viz. Of solidity, extension, figure, motion, or rest, and number." Close quote. Downing makes a compelling case that Locke agrees with Boyle in holding that corpuscular mechanism is uniquely intelligible. Because of this direct connection with between the fundamental microqualities and the qualities of ordinary experience. So taking the real essence to be the nominal essence brings it within it our epistemic reach. Corpuscular mechanism may not be true for all that, but if it isn't, the true alternative must necessarily be, to some degree, unintelligible to us. That's the idea. In sum, then, the upshot of this first version of the distinction depends on whether or not we adopt the corpuscular hypothesis. If we don't, primary qualities are special in that they are part of the nominal essence of body, the collection of qualities present in every body of ordinary experience and inseparable by the mind. If we do accept corpuscular mechanism, primary qualities are special in the deeper sense of being present in the real essence, in what it is to be the body, in that from which an object's other qualities flow. So this brings us to the doorstep of the second version of the distinction in terms of explanatory power. All of the object's qualities are to be explained in terms of the object's real essence. Primary qualities, then, are those included in the real essence, shape, size, and so on, again assuming corpuscular mechanism. They are explanatorily basic, and secondary qualities are explained in their terms. As an epistemologist, Locke is particularly interested in explaining the object's ability to produce ideas in us. Why does a snowball look spherical and white? Because of the arrangement of the qualities of the snowball's corpuscular parts. It looks spherical because of the way its corpuscles are arranged. It looks white because of the qualities of the corpuscles at its surface. Okay, but now there's a puzzle. What distinguishes the snowball's whiteness from its sphericalness? After all, both result from its aggregate corpuscular microstructure. But there is this key difference. The aggregate arrangement that produces the idea of sphericality is itself spherical, while an aggregate arrangement of corpuscular sizes, shapes, and motions at the surface just amounts to a larger, more complicated size, shape, and motion. So this is where the third version of the distinction comes into play. Primary qualities are special because their ideas resemble the powers that produce them, and the ideas of secondary qualities do not. Of course, the snowball example makes this look simpler than it is. The circular arrangement of a penny's corpuscles doesn't produce an idea of roundness when the penny is seen from an angle. It does, however, produce the idea of roundness at an angle, which is enough to distinguish it from the qualities of the corpuscles of the surface that produce the idea of copper color. Putting all this together and assuming corpuscular mechanism, we have the beginnings of a natural philosophical answer to the early modern's epistemological question. How do we manage to get reliable information about the world? The answer is that the world consists of corpuscles with primary qualities. These produce ideas in our minds. The ideas of primary qualities inform us of the primary qualities of the objects around us. The ideas of secondary qualities allow us to distinguish between objects, though without giving us direct information about them. Formulating this answer involves an interplay between all three versions of the primary-secondary distinction. Primary qualities are part of the real essence of body. Secondary qualities are separable from body. Primary qualities are explanatorily basic. Secondary qualities are explained in terms of primary qualities. The ideas of primary qualities resemble the powers in the body that produce them. The ideas of secondary qualities resemble nothing in the body that produces them. Between them, the three interrelated distinctions touch on conceptual, metaphysical, and epistemic themes. Okay, so given this portrait of the early modern primary-secondary distinction and its role, central to their natural philosophical epistemology, let's now ask how primary and secondary qualities figure in today's marketplace of ideas. What topics in this vicinity capture the imagination, command the attention of the contemporary philosophical mainstream? I hardly count myself as finely attuned to such matters, but I think it's fair to say that sessions at disciplinary meetings, books and articles published, PhDs awarded, all suggest widespread concern with the nature of secondary qualities, primarily color, and more primarily color ontology. A first pass at the range of positions would include various forms of subjectivism, color is in the head, objectivism or physicalism, color is in the object, and relationalism or dispositionalism, color is a relation between the object and the head, color is a disposition in the object to produce certain experiences in the head. But philosophical ingenuity has moved the debate far beyond this crude beginning. For example, the opening chapter of Jonathan Cohen's The Red and the Real develops a taxonomy of at least 7 general categories, each with 2 additional toggles, for a total of at least 28 possibilities. Well, of course, the participants in this lively debate are well aware that the primary-secondary distinction traces back to the early modern period. Unfortunately, those looking to the early moderns for inspiration are frustrated to find them fluctuating between quite different positions without apparent embarrassment. So, for example, Zed Adams, in his thought-provoking History of Color Concepts, lays out an array of possible positions and a string of quotations from Descartes, then remarks, quote, "If we ask ourselves which of these positions Descartes holds, the answer is that he seems to hold all of them, which is obviously problematic," close quote. Similarly, Jacobides describes Locke's careless attitude toward color ontology, and Downing remarks that, quote, "Boyle does not seem overly concerned with this question," close quote. Wilson sums up this way. She says, "Descartes, Boyle, Locke, and other writers of the period could vacillate rather unselfconsciously among the views of, say, colors as dispositions or powers to cause sensations, as mechanistic structures and objects that accounted for the powers, or as sensations themselves. Present-day philosophers find it necessary to defend one or another of these, or still different, positions, while conscientiously seeking to demonstrate the untenability of his rivals," close quote. She traces the discrepancy here to what I think many would regard as its source, the contemporary embrace of, quote, "more exacting standards of rigor than were characteristic of the 17th century treatments," close quote. But there's something odd in all this. If we look back at the early modern epistemological story sketched a moment ago, a story with a starring role for the distinction between primary and secondary qualities, we can't help but notice that it was easily told without taking any stand on the ontology of color and other secondary qualities. It involves primary qualities in the object producing ideas of us, some of which resemble features of the objects and some of which don't. Nothing in this requires us to determine whether color is the qualities, an arrangement of the corpuscles, the disposition to cause the idea, or the idea itself. All that matters is the idea doesn't resemble the qualities and arrangement of the corpuscles. So maybe the reason Locke, Boyle, and others don't take a firm view on this matter isn't because they're sloppy or unrigorous, but because they don't care. Or better, maybe it isn't even a question that presents itself to them, in something like the way the nature of the general notion of knowledge apparently didn't. In fact, there are hints in the writings of some of our early modern natural philosophers that the question of color ontology isn't just without interest, but that it may even be ill-posed. As he works his way up from smell and taste to hearing and touch, Reed writes, quote, "If it is asked whether the smell be in the rose or in the mind that feels it, the answer is obvious. There are two different things signified by the smell of the rose, one of which is in the mind, the other is truly and properly in the rose. All the names we have for smells, tastes, sounds, and for the various degrees of heat and cold have a like ambiguity. They signify both a sensation and a quality perceived by means of that sensation," close quote. This ambiguity in the terms leads to conflict. He says the vulgar say that fire is hot and snow cold and sugar sweet, and that to deny this is a gross absurdity and contradicts the testimony of our senses. The philosopher says that heat and cold and sweetness are nothing but sensations in our minds, and it's absurd to conceive that these sensations are in the fire or in the snow or in the sugar, close quote. Now, if there's a real metaphysical fact of the matter to be settled here, either the vulgar or the philosopher must be wrong. But Reed believes that, quote, "this contradiction between the vulgar and the philosopher is more apparent than real," close quote. It's what we would call merely verbal, he says, owing to the abusive language on the part of the philosopher and to indistinct notions on the part of the vulgar, close quote. The philosopher is abusing language because, on the ordinary, ambiguous sense, fire is hot. The vulgar notion is indistinct because his usage is ambiguous. Once each understands the sense in which their respective claims are met, the disagreement vanishes. Well, in the context of Newton's more sophisticated account of color vision, which includes light rays as potentially colored alongside the object and the experience, Howard Stein writes, quote, It seems to me a strange view of philosophy that holds that there is a single canonically right use of the word color, close quote. Reed at least rejects this strange view. The causal story of the object, the light, the stimulations of the visual system, and the phenomenal experience can be described without any decision on which color, which portion is really colored. In a similar key, Stein remarks, quote, the questions that arise about colors, about, in ordinary parlance, the colors of things, of the sky, the sun, of the nocturnal and diurnal moon, can be discussed in a way I have tried to exemplify in my earlier remarks, without any doctrine about the ontology of color. And such discussion, I hope I have convinced you by those examples, can genuinely satisfy the curiosity expressed by such questions. Again, without any need to take a stand one way or the other on the issue of whether colors are, in some fundamental sense, really in the things, close quote. So given that our questions about how color vision works and why the sky looks blue can all be answered without a stand on color ontology, the natural philosopher might well conclude that which element of the causal chain we regard as colored is a linguistic matter, a matter of labeling, that the ontological question is asking for a fact of the matter where there is none. At the very least, then, these early modern natural philosophers weren't interested in the ontological question about color. At worst, they thought it ill-posed. This suggests that in terms of our just-so stories, the emergence of color ontology as a central theme, like that of the nature of knowledge, wasn't an Austin Russell-style case of natural philosophical matter left behind as the science spins off, but a Kant-started-it-style case of a newly independent philosophy posing a question of its own, to be settled by its own methods. This returns us to a more focused version of the question posed a while back. If these mainstream contemporary concerns are new, not the same as the early modern concerns, then what has happened to those early modern concerns? In particular, as color ontology has taken center stage, what's become of the focal points of the early modern discussions of primary and secondary qualities? Okay, well, recall once again that the early modern epistemological story involved three versions of the primary-secondary distinction. Part of the concept body or not, explanatorily basic or not, resemble or not. When the distinction reaches its full development in Locke, the role of the conceptual distinction is to anchor the case for the unique intelligibility of corpuscular mechanism, the very properties that comprise our nominal essence of body, size, shape, motion, and also comprise its real essence, that is, the properties from which all others flow, the explanatorily basic properties. The key components of the story, then, are two: intelligible explanatorily basic properties, qualities, and ideas, some of which resemble and some of which don't. So let's take these up in turn. As we've seen, Locke's hope that the uniquely intelligible primary qualities of corpuscular mechanism would explain all the properties of objects was under pressure even in the essay from the cohesion of bodies and the workings of contact forces. As understanding has progressed, Locke's worries have been sustained. Both these phenomena turn out to be beyond the reach of mechanistic thinking. Both turn out to be electromagnetic phenomena. Here, the explanatorily basic properties are the values of the electromagnetic field, qualities undreamt of in early modern thinking and entirely absent from the nominal essence generated from Locke's perceivable grain of wheat. Here, as elsewhere, the requirement of intelligibility in Locke's sense necessarily falls away. Today, we have the wild menagerie of particles detailed in the standard model with properties like spin and color charge. Some would take these particles as fundamental and spin, color, and so on as explanatorily basic. Others seek to explain the particles in terms of more fundamental quantum fields, whose values would then be explanatorily basic. Still others would reduce both these to the mysterious strings of string theory. So this aspect of the early modern role for primary qualities, marking the search for physical fundamentals, is very much alive today. A natural label for this contemporary study would be foundations of physics. For that matter, much of what our early moderns were up to could be described in that way. Nowadays, when science and philosophy are regarded as distinct enterprises, It's worth noting that some contributors to this discussion are housed in philosophy departments and some in physics departments. Those in philosophy departments would most often be regarded as philosophers of physics, but of a particular breed. Some philosophers of physics, some philosophers of science more generally, take their questions from mainstream philosophy, say the problem of universals, and look to physics to answer them. This is philosophy informed by physics. In contrast, those participating in what I'm here calling foundations of physics take their questions from the physics, lending a hand with the questions that arise there, like those above about the explanatory basicness of particles, fields, or strings that arise there within the science. Philosophers of physics engaged in this project are sometimes challenged to explain why their work isn't just physics, isn't just science. Their rightful membership in the distinctive inquiry of philosophy is sometimes questioned. Likewise, those theoretical physicists similarly engaged might be accused of straying from their own disciplinary norms. This is unsurprising given that the early moderns, given that both groups are addressing questions of a piece with those of our early moderns, questions formulated in an arena where philosophy and science aren't separable. This is the natural philosophical residue left over after most of physics spins off, Russell Austin style, into a distinct, well-regulated discipline. So, if the worldly side of the early modern epistemic story, the side that counts primary qualities as explanatorily basic, lives on in the foundations of physics, what's become the cognitive side, the relation between the world so described and our cognition? The key there, notion there, is resemblance, primary qualities of those whose ideas resemble. As it happens, the most salient case, perception of size, shape, and distance by sight, has been central to theorizing about vision from the start. By the early modern period, Kepler's discovery of the retinal image had contributed to the rise of the theory of ideas, and with it the tendency to phrase the problem in its terms. How do we get accurate information about three-dimensional shape, size, and distance from a two-dimensional projection? Descartes, Berkeley, and Reed all discuss these matters in detail, often including experimental work, and, as noted, Berkeley especially had a profound influence on the discipline that eventually spun off Russell Austin style in contemporary vision science. Meanwhile, Newton was studying the study of color vision, showing how to predict the color experience that would result from a given combination of rays. In the centuries since, visual perception of the world's geometric figures has turned out to be a complex and subtle business involving intensive processing, stereopsis, and visual clues, the bluish cast of distant mountains. Though space itself is locally Euclidean, our visual experience of it is neither perfect resemblance nor a two-dimensional projection. A long alleyway looks narrower in the distance, but it doesn't look like two converging lines on a plane as a projection would. It's some kind of foreshortened three-dimensional space whose structure is a lively topic of contemporary research. The mechanics and physiology of color vision are comparatively well understood. So in this case, the updated version of the early modern secondary distinction would be the question, are worldly size, shape, and distance, and so on, registered differently from the workings of color vision? Phenomenally, the answer would seem to be yes. It's natural to think that our experiences of size, shape, distance present themselves as geometric, while our color experiences bear no resemblance to anything external. But physiologically, both are simply encodings of certain features of the world. The question then is whether there's a principal difference between the way the system for spatial vision and the system for color vision register information. This is part of a larger inquiry into the mechanics of vision, which might be called the foundations of vision science. Here, once again, we find a joint project of researchers from what are officially different forms of inquiry, this time from departments of philosophy and of psychology or cognitive science. In other words, here too, we find a residue left behind when a science spins off into independence, this time vision science, and practitioners who straddle the disciplines, or maybe better, practitioners who pursue a single enterprise that's artificially segmented by our contemporary insistence that philosophy and science are distinct undertakings. Let's just call them natural philosophers and leave them be. This brings us full circle at last. We began with Austin, who recommended a certain topic, excuses as well suited to a given method, ordinary language philosophizing. Reversing the order, I set out to recommend a certain method, natural philosophizing, as well suited to a given topic, the world and our place in it. To describe the method, I returned to the early moderns, especially Descartes, Boyle, Locke, Newton, Berkeley, and Reid, and called attention to their seamless integration of what we now call philosophy and what we now call science. Tracing the history forward, the concerns of these natural philosophers survive in what we now consider as interdisciplinary inquiries in the foundations of physics and of vision science. Once we recognize the phenomena, it can be found in many other areas, in consciousness research, in the foundations of mathematics, and the theory of evolution, and more. The fact that pretty much any science that's spun off from natural philosophical core has left behind some Russell Austin-style foundational residue. Okay, so where does this leave the questions that spun off instead, as Kant started it, independent philosophical questions? I suggested that inquiry into the nature of knowledge is such a question. When the topic, the world and our place in it, was introduced, I postponed consideration of what it leaves out. The nature of knowledge now presents itself as a potential example. It seems we could have a complete account of how, for example, the visual system registers information without touching on the question of whether the agent knows or sees that in the presence of papier-mâché barns. Presumably, even a complete account of all the ways we gain reliable information wouldn't tell us whether knowing is a factive, purely mental state. These contemporary epistemological questions appear to float free of what's going on in the world. To put the point another way, does the world contain a concept knowledge to be analyzed, or a worldly item knowledge to be studied, or just a word, knowledge, with an impressive array of subtle and effective ordinary language uses, a suitable topic for Austin's ordinary language philosophizing? I suggest that what we've seen supports the final option. If this is right, then the contemporary philosopher's questions about knowledge, intended in some other sense, outstrip the target topic here, the world and our place in it. This conclusion runs parallel to our previous musings on the question of color ontology. It seems we could have a complete account of color vision, from the microphysics of the object to the behavior of light to the workings of the visual system, and still not have an answer to the central question of color ontology. What is color? Updating Reid, the contemporary psychologist Davida Teller writes, quote, "As far as I can see, color realism is the view that of the vision scientist's three entities, surface spectral reflectance, neural signals, perceived color, one is color and the other two are not. But if you ask a color scientist which of the three entities is color, she will answer that the question is ill-posed. We care much more about our fundamental distinctions than we do about who owns the word color. The argument seems to me to collapse into an uninteresting terminological dispute," close quote. As Stein put it, why insist on a single right use of the word? If something does determine the right use, then it too seems to fall outside the scope of our topic. In general, then, Kant started its style independent philosophical questions float free of the early modern inquiry and its natural philosophical descendants. This doesn't establish that they're pseudo-questions. They may well be part of a different inquiry with its own methods, as Kant claimed. But for those of us set on investigating the world and our place in it, if that's your topic, I stand by my recommendation. Take counsel from the early moderns, stick with Reid's modest response to Hume, and adopt the seamless methods of the natural philosopher.